For our blind and print-impaired listeners, the North Carolina Reading Service presents... The Indie Week issue, dated March 9th, 2022. And reading this week's issue, as usual, is John Federson. And our first article by Brooke Doherty from Chapel Hill, Safer Streets. On New Year's Eve, a car crashed into two middle school girls as they were crossing the street on Estes Drive in Chapel Hill, seriously injuring them both. In January, a car door struck a cyclist, Nicholas Watson, on West Franklin Street. He passed away 2 weeks later. According to Chapel Hill police, drivers hit 16 people in crosswalks in just over a year. Six people walking or riding bikes were struck between New Year's Eve and February the 1st alone. So it's no wonder that the question of how to address the traffic safety crisis has become a top concern for Chapel Hill council members in recent weeks. Mayor Pro Tem Karen Stegman said during a work session last month, "We are literally talking about life and death when we talk about what we're doing with our streets and how we're making them safe for everybody and not just for cars. We've got to prioritize safety above everything else." Over the past month, the council and community members have met over Zoom to discuss infrastructure upgrades and policy changes to address road safety. At a February 9 meeting, Bergen Watterson, the town's transportation planning manager, said that failure to reduce speed and inattention were among the top contributing circumstances to pedestrian and bike crashes, with crosswalks being the main problem area. Carson Spanarski, a cyclist and decade-long employee at the bicycle chain in Chapel Hill, says he has had some bad experiences and close calls while biking around Chapel Hill, including encountering bike lanes hidden by cars or marked poorly, especially on side streets and at intersections, and cars pulling out in front of him unaware they are crossing over a bike lane. The biggest safety issues that need to be addressed, Spanarski says, are inadequate lane markings, the absence of separation between pedestrians, cyclists, and cars, and the lack of visibility, especially on Franklin Street. He says, citing that accident that killed Watson, "The most important thing is letting people know what areas are designated as cycling lanes and then providing good separation between those lanes and roadways." He was using that multi-use lane on Franklin Street, and because that's not marked as a bike lane and doesn't have any separation from the parking other than the temporary cones, the passenger of the car that opened the door didn't know they needed to be careful and be looking out for cyclists. It's just confusing. People don't know if that's an extended sidewalk or bike lane. Watson's death comes as NCDOT seeks public input on how to improve its bike route systems. Comments can be submitted online at ncdot.altaplanning.cloud. ncdot.altaplanning.cloud. That's the state's bike route system public input map portal. And those can be made through March 14th. Coming right up, folks. Coming right up. Input will be used to update the DOT statewide bike and pedestrian plan known as Walk Bike NC, which was last updated in 2013. According to the department, NCDOT is initiating another update to the route system based on a more current review of existing and planned bicycle facilities throughout the state. The public is invited to help identify additional potential changes to the system based on recent roadway projects, local planning, and local knowledge and understanding of the routes. The accidents that killed Watson and injured the middle school girls occurred on roadways owned and maintained by the NC Department of Transportation. That dynamic limits the extent that Chapel Hill can get involved and make specific safety changes, such as altering speed limits, installing vertical barriers, and increasing the visibility of crosswalks in a timely and effective manner. While DOT maintains 44% of road miles in Chapel Hill, 78% of pedestrian crashes and 93% of bike crashes in 2020 occurred on those roads. 24 of the 38 accidents that involved either a bicycle or pedestrian last year were also on state-maintained roads, according to town officials. Watterson said in an email to the Indy, "The DOT roads in Chapel Hill are the widest, fastest, and highest volume roadways in town. They are also our primary corridors that provide the most direct routes to where people want and need to go. These crashes are probably a combination of the dangerous nature of the road and the need for people to walk and bike on the roadways to get where they're going efficiently." Watterson says NCDOT often requires municipalities to provide a traffic impact analysis to prove safety improvements are needed. And he says NCDOT places a lot of importance on the level of service for vehicles, meaning they're most concerned with moving vehicles quickly and efficiently. When the town wants to make safety improvements, for example, in lane relocation, installing no right on red signs, or any type of traffic calming, we must hire a consultant to do a traffic impact analysis to prove that the proposed changes will not significantly negatively impact the flow of traffic. This quote continues, "Our experience has been that NCDOT pushes back on any proposed changes that would cause the level of service to drop too far, even if it would improve safety for vulnerable road users. Despite these setbacks, at the February 9th meeting, Watterson presented the various safety precautions that Chapel Hill can make and the programs that have recently been utilized. They include the continuation of the Pedestrian Safety Action Plan and Vision Zero, a global safety strategy that Chapel Hill adopted in October 2021. The Vision Zero commitment is to prioritize the safety of vulnerable road users over transportation decisions and eliminate traffic deaths and serious injuries by 2031, according to the town's website. The Vision Zero program aims to change the design of Chapel Hill's community and roads by collecting data about collisions through an online dashboard in order to determine the most effective areas for safety improvements." And he said at the council meeting, "Over the next year, we are going to work to update our Pedestrian Safety Action Plan based on the improved data that we have and might be able to drill down a little bit closer for specific location and types of improvements. Next steps include coordinating with the DOT on a speed safety study on Estes Drive, collaborating with UNC Highway Safety Research Center for additional safety studies, and implementing curb-running bike lanes. Chapel Hill has also had success making strategic, small-scale pedestrian improvements, such as installing rapid flashing beacons at crosswalks across Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard and Franklin Street. But larger-scale improvements that would make a more significant safety impact are difficult for the town to fund." Watterson said in an email, "DOT will allow the town to fund and install some safety improvements, if approved. However, addressing safety on roads like MLK, Franklin, Fordham, etc., takes more than small-scale, one-off safety improvements that the town has installed. In addition to these efforts, local law enforcement is cracking down on driving violations around crosswalks. Chapel Hill Police last month announced that the department had conducted 41 pedestrian safety operations recently, which resulted in drivers being ticketed for speeding, failing to yield at crosswalks, and committing other infractions that threaten pedestrians. Police Chief Chris Blue told council last month that the best response to the challenges with bike and pedestrian safety are those that involve meaningful environmental and engineering changes, and that enforcement is only part of the holistic response to creating that safe system in our community. And quote, "We have grown increasingly concerned that while we work on those longer-term solutions, we continue to see disturbing driving behaviors in our community, with sometimes deadly consequences." Blue said enforcement efforts will continue for the foreseeable future, with the hope they can be scaled back when long-term remedies and engineering and environmental solutions are implemented. Charles Edwards, DOT's Orange County District Engineer, says his department has engineers and planners who work collaboratively with town staff to tackle transportation and safety issues, but changes require a process. And he says if there is work to be done or changes to be made to the infrastructure that is on DOT streets, yes, there are DOT standards and processes that have to be followed there. If work is to be undertaken by the town within a DOT road, it can be handled through an administrative encroachment agreement process that authorizes that work after the work has been reviewed and approved by DOT relative to appropriate engineering standards. And the Durham County District Engineer John Sandor says, while he can't speak directly about Chapel Hill, he's worked the municipal side for the city of Raleigh, and that frustration stems from differing interests and responsibilities. And he says, it really comes down to, in a lot of cases, what our responsibilities are, and municipalities' responsibilities are smaller in scale than what DOT's are. As long as everyone sort of understands everybody's opinion or responsibility in the overall system, they can come to the table and work through the process. Sanders says there are a variety of things that DOT has to look at, dissect, and discuss, and he believes having a detailed approach will help avoid situations like traffic buildup. DOT approaches things as very data-driven, and everything is random unless we can prove otherwise. I think that is a very practical approach because DOT can get political, and so we have to rely on that data and metrics to really fall back on, says Sandor. If we knee-jerk and react to every politician, we'll have painted ourselves into a corner where we could never get out of, with traffic everywhere and people can't get anywhere. It's not a good look for NC to have that. Chapel Hill Council members recently voted to approve curb-running bike lanes, a decision that needed to happen before DOT resurfaces and restripes West Franklin Street this summer. Curb-running bike lanes are considered an upgrade as they separate cyclists from moving vehicles by positioning them between the curb and parked cars. Several council members voiced concerns about potential conflicts between cyclists and vehicles at driveways and intersections, an issue that could be fixed by placing physical barriers between bikes and traffic to maintain safety. But DOT prefers to not have anything on the road that could come in contact with cars or affect traffic. Chapel Hill Mayor Pam Heminger said about the reasoning, "You have to look at their mission, which is to get cars to move as fast through a situation as possible. When you have a barricade, there is a likelihood that a car could hit it. And there are concerns about pedestrians being out there and the barriers being hit and not stable enough to protect the pedestrians." The council has discussed the potential for Chapel Hill to apply to have the maintenance of Franklin Street transferred from DOT to the town. The transfer of maintenance could take between 3 months to a year, but would supply Chapel Hill with more authority over safety changes. 7 of the 38 pedestrian or bike-involved car accidents last year occurred within the 4-minute walk from University United Methodist Church on East Franklin Street to the intersection of North Columbia and Rosemary Street. Heminger says you have to submit a request, and the council would have to vote on that request to Department of Transportation. The town would then become responsible for all maintenance on the road. The state's Powell Bill Fund for Future Maintenance could partially reimburse Chapel Hill. And Heminger says, we're seeing other North Carolina towns taking over their main street from DOT so they could slow things down and really focus on the pedestrian and bike experience. Chapel Hill plans to wait to submit an application until after DOT finishes repaving roads this summer, she says. Quote, we want to be able to put physical barriers in the road, even in the middle of the crosswalks, to help pedestrians feel safer. Other potential changes include installing separators for bike lanes and replacing orange cone barriers with more attractive methods such as planters. She says, quote, "We're not sure we're going to end up with a bike lane there, but for now we had to turn in a plan and we felt that was the safer of the two for everyone involved." In addition to having more authority over bike lanes, Chapel Hill could also potentially bump out the curb at Columbia and Franklin Street, something Heminger has advocated for years. And the town's planning manager, Watterson, says it would make the distance traveled for pedestrians shorter, and that is something the DOT has not allowed. "We have the opportunity to do that with physical barriers if we take the street back over, and there are a couple other places where we could bump out to again that slows cars down and gives pedestrians a shorter distance to cross the road." Watterson says Chapel Hill is only in the preliminary stages of exploring what transferring road maintenance from DOT would look like. And before taking over the road, the town should have a robust public engagement process to determine what the future vision for Franklin Street would be. Quote, "Staff expects to share a public input plan with council later this spring, and we hope to have more solid information related to the maintenance transfer process by then. For now, Chapel Hill wants to ensure pedestrian and cyclist safety, instigate changes that will focus on the most vulnerable road users, and be proactive about potential issues." And Heminger says, "We've got to do a better job. The number of incidents of pedestrians and bicyclists being hit across the county is on the rise, and that's the opposite direction we want to go. We're trying to figure out how to make it safer and network in our town, too, so people can ride to work and events and activities on their bikes or walk and feel completely safe. We have a team on staff that's reviewing every incident and receiving recommendations that come from the public. We're really taking these things seriously. We don't want people to get hurt in our community." And I'll repeat that website, which is open for public comment on how to improve bike routes until March 14th, coming right up. That's ncdot.altaplanning.cloud. That's the Bike Route System Public Input Map portal. And next, Brooke Doherty writes from Hillsboro, "Preservation Purchase. Those who enjoy the rolling waters, winding trails, and conveniently located campsites of the Eno River State Park could soon have more of it to love. Over the past year and a half, the Eno River Association has worked to buy 226 acres of land near downtown Hillsboro from the Classical American Homes Preservation Trust, a nonprofit with a mission to preserve examples of classic American residential architecture, along with their surrounding landscapes and trails. If the purchase goes through, the NC Division of Parks and Recreation and the nonprofit Archaeological Conservancy would own and conserve the land for generations to come. The transaction includes the Eno River Bend parcel and more than 200 acres of proposed Eno River State Park land. Together, those properties contain 2.8 miles of river and tributary frontage, over 4 miles of walking trails, the Okinichi Speedway, and downtown Hillsboro locations of the earliest known settlements along the Eno River, historical parcels listed on the National Registry of Historical Places with 14 known rare plant and animal species. Founded back in 1966, the Eno River Association is an accredited land trust and watershed nonprofit. According to its website, its mission is to acquire land and conservation easements to ensure the preservation of water quality, wildlife, and cultural resources of the Eno River Basin in Orange County and northern Durham, and to make the outdoors enjoyable and accessible for everyone. Now, Jessica Sheffield, Executive Director of the Eno River Association, says this historic land sale is rare and exciting, saying, "This project and property is completely mission-focused for us and is just a perfect match, transferring this land to the State and Archaeological Conservancy. Those two new owners will ensure that the natural history and cultural features of the property remain forever protected and will continue to be open for public use. A top priority for both the association and the trust is to ensure that the property, located around the trust's Air Mount Historic Site," that's a federal era plantation house just outside Hillsboro, "will continue to be properly managed and remain a community resource." Kevin Cherry, vice president of the trust, says, "Ensuring the long-term stewardship of these unique properties was our primary objective for working with the association. With this transaction, the ecology of the area will be preserved, the speedway will remain accessible for low-impact recreation, and the archaeological sites will be protected and available for research and teaching." As part of the historic land sale, the Preservation Trust will donate 23% of the $2 million plus land value. The association's goal is to raise the remaining funds over the next year through public and private sources and donors. So far, the nonprofit has received a $100,000 gift from the Harkrader family to jumpstart fundraising that it hopes to match by year's end. Kim Livingston, Director of Conservation and Stewardship, who's leading the project, says the Eno River Association has also applied for funding for the NC Land and Water Fund, a state grant source, and that the NC Division of Parks and Recreation plans to apply for federal land and conservation fund in the coming months. Livingston says that projects of this scale take a while to accomplish. Their grant sources often only have one cycle per year, and they are never guaranteed. Still, a decision on the public grant sources could come by the end of 2022, saying, "If we are not awarded those public grants, we will go after those grants again in 2023 and also increase our private fundraising efforts to support this project." The protected land to be sold functions as a stream buffer and wildlife corridor for over 2.8 miles of river and tributaries, and will continue to support wildlife and preserve clean water along the Eno River. In addition, the property boasts 14 known national heritage elements, including rare animals such as the Neuse River water dog, the yellow lamp mussel, and the mottled dusky wing. The Eno River Bend, a future Archaeological Conservancy property, spans 20 acres and is part of historic downtown Hillsboro. The parcel contains remains of four known early settlements that date back to AD 1000, including those that date back to AD 1690 on the Eno River from the Okanichee Band of the Saponi Nation Village. Kelly Berliner, the Eastern Regional Director for the Archaeological Conservancy, says that the archaeological sites located at this bend in the Eno River significantly inform our understanding of Native American life in the Piedmont region from AD 1000 until the early 1700s. Quote, "This was a time period that was complicated as Native people reacted to and interacted with European trade goods and settlers coming into the area." The Archaeological Conservancy is working with the Okanichee Band of Saponi Nation to ensure the sites are protected and guarantee Native American access to all of its preserves. In addition to the early settlement remains, that 200-acre portion of the land transaction proposed for the Eno River Park expansion contains the historic Okanichee Speedway Trail. That's the only surviving dirty speedway from the NASCAR inaugural 1949 season. and will include the James M. Johnston State Dedicated Nature Preserve. The North Carolina Mountains to Sea Trail and the Riverwalk run through the Eno River Bend property, allowing easy access for visitors and accessibility to downtown Hillsboro shops and restaurants. This section of the parcel is already open for the public to use. The Eno River State Park saw more than 1 million visitors in both 2020 and 2021 during the pandemic. Officials say the new acres of state park in downtown Hillsboro are expected to attract even more new visitors. This connection of trails to downtown Hillsboro should boost the town's revenue and help its plans for walkability, so people can enjoy the river, shops, and restaurants without having to drive. And as a closer to this article, the Eno River Association will host events later this month for people to learn more, including guided hikes along the Eno at the historic Okeechobee Speedway on March 26. Visitors can choose from three hikes themed around the speedway, nature, or indigenous history and culture. In addition, the Eno River Association will hold a virtual info session on April the 6th. Now, Jane Porter's column from Raleigh, Equitable Design. The red, blue, and beige terrazzo floor design in the Aldred Gallery in Kampfhoffner Hall on NC State University campus is aspect a far cry from Silent Sam, the bronze Confederate monument the students toppled on the Chapel Hill campus in the summer of 2018. But the floor, installed in 2012, had its inspiration, Le Corbusier, an icon of modern architecture, are stirring similar feelings among some students on the Raleigh campus that generations of Chapel Hill students felt for decades before they tore down Silent Sam. Le Corbusier was a known misogynist, homophobe, anti-Semite, and more recent scholarship indicates an associate of European fascist leaders and authoritarian sympathizer. It's problematic, then, some students say, that Le Corbusier's legacy is effectively honored with a floor pattern inspired by his work, a quote, a drawing, and his signature in a room in one of the College of Design's busiest buildings. Last fall, the students launched a petition and website and blanketed the university's campus with pamphlets calling attention to the Aldred Gallery design and its inspiration, an architect who, quote, used his drawing as a way to objectify and terrorize marginalized people, according to the student petition, which had 112 signatures as of Monday. The text of the petition continues, all of this fills the Aldred Gallery, where students and faculty are supposed to congregate, and the floor pattern is an invitation for fascists to find solidarity within the College of Design the same way it has given Nazis validations in the past. There's no way to keep Le Corbusier's work without perpetuating his ideals. The group of students behind this effort makes clear that the gallery's floor and Le Corbusier display needs to be redesigned. Boa Stonehart, a graduate student of the College of Design, says, if you choose not to do anything, then it is more so sending a message to certain people to feel comfortable on this campus expressing these kinds of views. Whereas if you take it down, you're saying we don't accept that. Si Tong Veng, a fourth-year student studying environmental architecture in the College of Design, is disappointed that the university, quote, has not released any official statement or taken a stance. I think it's the school's responsibility to guide us in the right direction. It's not clear how the university decided to install the Le Corbusier-inspired floor display in the Aldred Gallery a decade ago, following a 2007 redesign of the building, but it doesn't seem to have been a controversial decision at the time. And it's curious that it's taken until now to have caused a stir. Professor Hernan Merchant, a Corbusian scholar, was involved with the design and installation process. According to a video on YouTube from the David Allen Company, the material supplier, Marchant did not respond to the Indies' request for comment. Students say when they learned about Le Corbusier's work in many of their classes in the College of Design, the architect's troubling views were glossed over by professors, at best. At worst, they say Le Corbusier was glorified. Burak Erdim, an associate professor of architecture in the College of Design and an architectural historian, says since the 1980s, a number of essays from scholars have drawn attention to Le Corbusier's affiliation with authoritarian, technocratic, imperialist, and fascist regimes. Erdim is one of the few professors, students say, who has noted Le Corbusier's ties to authoritarianism in the classroom and provided space for discussion. He wrote in an email to the Indy, "Most recently, and within the last 10 years, the field of architectural history has also begun a broader project to critically re-examine the historiography of modern architecture and planning. Drawing on this scholarship, students are raising the question of what does an iconic figure like Le Corbusier mean to us in contemporary architectural education and practice." He says he's proud of the students' effort. Quote, "Students are actually building on what they are learning. This is a great conversation to have, theoretically, and especially in relation to a space that we occupy and use on a daily basis. They're putting the kinds of tropes of critical analysis that we look at in the classroom in the way they are looking at what this figure means to us, to our contemporary architectural education and practice." Administrators in the School of Architecture and the College of Design are taking a diplomatic approach to addressing the issue. Following meetings in November and December and a third meeting Friday, they and the students have come up with a process designed to educate the campus community, students, staff, and alumni about the issue through workshops and other events. And it is a problem-solving exercise, they emphasize. They won't commit to any specific outcome. David Hill, a professor of architecture, says, "The idea of redesigning the gallery is an interesting one because that is what we do. And as part of the design process, there are several stages along the way. First and foremost, we seek to understand a client, or in this case, to understand how students feel about this particular floor and the messages and symbols that it holds that are offensive. Not unlike how we would deal with the client and user groups, to understand how to design a building more appropriately and to develop empathy." Mark Hoverstein, a professor of landscape and architecture and the dean of the NCSU's College of Design, says, "Once you know how people feel, what they want, and their hopes and dreams, then you can set about working through the design process and design iterations. We take several stabs at something before we know we get it right. So it will be interesting to hear from the students and others in the school's community about what redesign might mean. There are probably a million different ways we could think about redesigning that floor." The students acknowledge that the educational component of the process is a crucial one. Kunal Bardwaj, a fourth-year student in the College of Design, says, "It's important to teach everybody about this stuff. It's important to learn and think about what our opinions are. Breaking up the redesign process is even more beneficial because then it can be surgical in how you design the space. Sure, you can have an information session, really discuss it, but then get to each conflict that we or anyone else brings up, concerns from the other side, concerns from our side." While they're committed to following the process, some of the students are frustrated with the pace of the administration's engagement and its circumspect approach, especially at a university that touts equity and inclusion in its mission statement. Stonehart, the graduate student, said, "Equity is not necessarily democratic. It's raising people up that haven't had that support. It's not about equality, it's about equity. About going above and beyond to help people, not about hearing everyone's opinion equally." to Raleigh, and now Jasmine Gallup and Jane Porter co-author Blurred Lines. Raleigh's first in-person city council meeting since the COVID pandemic devolved into name-calling last week as angry residents railed against the city's new district map. Despite residents' concerns, including whether the redistricting plan complied with the Federal Voting Rights Act, council members ultimately approved the map in a 7-1 vote. Officials began the redistricting process last year after decennial census data revealed that the populations of District A and B were out of balance with Districts C, D, and E. The city is required to withdraw its election district every 10 years to assure each has a relatively equal population, so everyone's vote carries the same weight. The 12 people who spoke against the new district map Tuesday all had similar complaints that Black and Latinx communities were being split up and their voices and votes would go unheard. Their primary concern was over the Brentwood and Green Road neighborhoods in North Raleigh, which are majority Black and Latino. Under the new map, those voting precincts are moved from District B, also a majority-minority area, to District A, a majority white area. Councilman David Cox, the lone opposing vote, said he was worried the new map was not racially equitable. Quote, "We ended up moving about 55,000 people, which is about 12% of Raleigh's population. The majority, nearly 60%, are non-white. So even though District B still predominantly has a minority population, that minority population is being diluted as a result of the new map. It also begs the question of how, in a city that is majority white, do we end up with a plan that moves a majority of non-white citizens?" In an additional statement to the Indy, Cox emphasized that 70% of the people in District B who were redistricted were racial minorities, and that of the 55,000 people redistricted through the city, 55% are minority. An astounding result given that the city's overall majority is white, he said. Following the delayed release of the census data till last September, city staff was instructed to provide to members of a council-approved study group redistricting options based on population equality, geographic contiguity, compactness, preservation of communities of interest, protection of incumbents, and consideration of future growth. The study group would then collect public input, analyze and provide feedback, pros and cons, on the different redistricting options to the city council. The group is the same one appointed to analyze council pay, term lengths, whether to add an additional district, and whether to stagger terms. City staff did not draw the new districts with public input, nor were they given the option to draw the maps with a new 6th district, something a majority of respondents to a city survey conducted by this group said they want, and which population growth over the last decade supports. If Raleigh gets a new 6th district, it will come after this year's election, so these new districts will only likely be in place for one election cycle. All three of the staff-drawn options moved minority precincts in minority-majority districts, districts B and C, into majority-white districts, A, D, and E, rather than vice versa, which advocates say dilutes the voting power of Black and Hispanic residents. Residents had opportunities to voice their concerns at 2 study group meetings in December, plus 2 additional community meetings, and could also email comments to the study group, but the study group members could not suggest modifications to those 3 map options or propose a different redistricting scenario. After the study group gave its feedback to the council, the majority of council members voted in favor of a redistricting proposal that reduced minority populations in District B from 62 to 54%. Planning Director Ken Bowers said the council chose the scenario in which population balance across the district was achieved, with all districts around 2% deviation. The boundaries better followed major transportation corridors. future annexation areas were more evenly divided between B and C. The diversity of districts was, quote, largely maintained, and District B had room to grow through future annexation. Local community members were emotional when they spoke about the proposal at the public hearing last week before the council vote. Angeline Echeverria said, a longtime Brentwood resident, I'd like you to keep my community of immigrant families together in District B. We deserve to be part of a district that takes into consideration the common experiences of migration, language barriers, and the racial and ethnic discrimination that unites us with established black communities in our area. Several nonprofit leaders also spoke out against the new map, including some who had previously been invited to give input on the redistricting process. During study group meetings last year, feedback from the groups was mixed. Speakers were optimistic about the approach that the city was taking toward redistricting, but also noted several potential issues with the proposed maps. On Tuesday, it was clear these groups ultimately felt left out of the process they had been invited to participate in. Brian Laws of the NC Counts Coalition said the study group members ignored his group's feedback. While the city did add an additional listening session at the Green Road Community Center, many people did not feel welcome, Laws said. We provided you all with information on what our communities need, and some of those comments were ignored, he said. He continued to speak after Mary Ann Baldwin reminded him his 1 minute of time was up. This matters, he said. The fact you have this many people here and they're only allowed to speak for 1 minute, that's the issue. I'm representing a group that you all actually reached out to. You asked us to speak on this matter, and that's why I'm here. Because we did the work, we studied, we looked at the data to provide you all with best practices for a better map. Maria Gonzalez of El Pueblo had similar comments. Although the city reached out to members of the Latino community, their voices ultimately went unheard, she said. City officials did not give people ample time to voice those concerns during the listening sessions, she added. Gonzalez said, we even tried to speak one-on-one after the session, but were brushed off each time. This was a chance for community leaders to speak out on an issue that directly impacts their life, and they were outright ignored. Bowers was put in the hot seat when he summarized input the study group received from nonprofits. In his initial presentation, Bowers said the nonprofits, quote, had many observations, but uncovered no significant flaws in the districts that were proposed. Later, Bowers acknowledged that several nonprofits raised the same concerns commenters had, that the voting power of minority communities would be diluted. But he said, quote, they did not consider at the time it to be an objectionable change in the racial demographics of the districts. Bowers specifically cited the Southern Coalition for Social Justice as saying the changes would not have a significant impact. Despite the criticism leveled at the new map and the process by which it was drawn, several council members continued to defend it. Councilman Patrick Bufkins, quote, I think the process that brought us to this point is a vast improvement over what we've done in the past. It's involved public comment. It's been an unprecedented level of transparency in the redistricting process that used to be handled behind closed doors without public input with districts drawn by politicians. And now this article continues by a look at the facts. Did the Southern Coalition for Social Justice support the new map when it was first presented? Yes, conditionally. Kotlin Kaiser, Council for Voting Rights for the SCSJ, made a presentation to the study group in December. At that time, Kaiser noted the lower percentage of minorities in District B, but said that despite the difference, quote, we believe voters of color will still have the opportunity to elect their candidates of choice. Throughout her presentation, however, Kaiser emphasized the importance of community feedback and acknowledged the coalition's analysis was not community vetted. At that time, she said the coalition's presentation may not take into account the concerns of people affected, and the city should continue outreach and consider the input of residents. She said, quote, "What is essential to this process and might be missing from our presentation is local community knowledge and understanding. Although these changes are slight, they will have an impact on where the community sees themselves, and if they are moved out of their communities of interest, so it's important to receive that feedback." Following Tuesday's meeting, Kaiser said the coalition supports the community's concerns about the new map splitting minority communities. During a phone call, she said, "There's a false narrative of transparency being provided by the city. One of the things I said in December was that these maps really mean nothing unless there is community input. If members are not happy with scenarios 1, 2, and 3, the city needs to draw an alternative map or make adjustments. Obviously, that didn't happen here." In a letter to the council outlining the nonprofit's concerns, Kaiser asked the council to call a special meeting to amend or annul the adopted map and adopt a revised map, quote, "with additional opportunities for meaningful community input and public comment as part of the process." And she wrote, "It is disappointing. The city council did not understand the central takeaway from our presentation. Raleigh should listen to residents' lived experiences and create a transparent redistricting process trusted by residents." The next tag. What is Section 2 of the 1965 Voting Rights Act? Opponents of the new map argue it was not in compliance with Section 2. Among other things, that section prohibits practices denying minority voters an equal opportunity, quote, "to participate in the political process and to elect representatives of their choice." The Brennan Center for Justice report said, quote, "A violation of this type is sometimes called vote dilution." According to that report, district lines can't dilute the voting power of minorities if a minority community can fit reasonably in a geographically compact district, if voting age minorities would represent a majority of the voters in that district, if the minority population would usually vote for the same candidate, if the white population would usually vote for a different candidate, and if the minority vote is not otherwise protected given the totality of the circumstances. Does Section 2 of that Voting Rights Act apply to municipalities like Raleigh? According to Robert Joyce, a lawyer and professor of public law and government at UNC Chapel Hill, yes, Section 2 remains in full force everywhere. Historically, that Voting Rights Act had two operative parts. Section 2 prohibited discrimination on the basis of race in matters related to voting everywhere in the country. The other part, Section 5, required states like North Carolina, which had been particularly discriminatory preceding that act, to obtain a pre-clearance for any changes to election law or practice. And he said, in 2013, the U.S. Supreme Court found that measures used to determine which parts of the country were to be subject to Section 5 had become sufficiently outdated that it could no longer be used. So Section 5 is no longer enforced, and there is no longer a pre-clearance requirement anywhere. The two sections are easy to mix up, Joyce says, adding that was probably what happened in a question-and-answer exchange between Councilman Bufkin and the city attorney during the Raleigh City Council meeting. Was that redistricting process transparent? Yes. Transparency means officials act openly and citizens know what decisions they make. Additionally, people affected by those decisions know about the data and process that leads to them. While the public was not invited to weigh in on the maps that the staff proposed, the study group's discussion of redistricting and the proposed maps were public. People could view the decision-making process and the data given to city council members. This year's process was much more transparent than the 2010 process, which happened behind closed doors. Still, the process was not transparent enough to satisfy some voting rights advocate. And last question, did the city engage the community? No. The city held 2 meetings and 4 listening sessions, conducted surveys, sent emails, provided information on social media, and gathered data and comments from community members, but did not seem to make any adjustments to the maps or the process based on the community feedback. Now, I believe I will have time to read most of this food and drink article written by Lena Geller called Not by Bread Alone. What's in $50? This is a question that Ari Berenbaum thinks about often. The owner of 9th Street Bakery also runs the Durham Neighbors Program, a grassroots organization he founded in February of 2021 that provides a micro donation of $50 a month to 100 Durham residents. Early in the pandemic, he'd begun handing out free lunches at the bakery whenever someone walked in and needed one. Since then, neighboring restaurant Luna Rotisserie has taken on a version of that initiative, providing 20 free lunches a day. Berenbaum says it became clear that, yes, folks need food, but they also need just money for basic expenses. I really believe in universal basic income, so I was just like, how can the bakery make this happen? Until November, about 90% of that monthly $5,000 in donations was funded through bakery revenue, with the remaining 10% footed by other local businesses and a handful of individual donors. Relief came around Thanksgiving last year when Berenbaum connected over social media with 2 locals who now help increase the program's visibility. Now, thanks to the work of volunteers Nicole Cranley and Amanda Hicks, community contributions fund almost 50% of the micro donations. Berenbaum says the program is all about narrowing the gap between donors and recipients. Person-to-person giving is the most impactful, swift, and meaningful type of assistance, and it makes community members more cognizant of the issues their neighbors are facing. And he says, a lot of people say, oh, $50, what will that buy you? But if your budget for things is very low each month, $50 proportionally is, for you or I, it could be hundreds and hundreds of dollars. And with more mainstream philanthropic models, he says it can be clear how much money actually gets to the front lines of folks that are in sometimes desperate need for money for necessities after overhead costs are deducted from those donations. Donating time and expertise to the program is also valuable, he says, adding there is a volunteer need for things like signing up to assist members with job hunting, setting up health care, and navigating public services. Folks can also help out by sharing the program's social media posts, which Cranley says have ambition beyond fundraising. He says, we're not just about trying to raise money, but also educate our followers about what we can do financially to better support our community through person-to-person giving. Let's dispel this idea that it's just free handouts. Founded by a family of activists, 9th Street Bakery originally opened on 9th Street in 1981. Durham Neighbors, Berenbaum says, aligns with the deep-rooted social mission of the bakery. Quote, I think 9th Street is kind of a holdover from another era in Durham before all this burgeoning development happened. Durham is actually 2 in many ways. Natasha Adams was one of Durham Neighbors' first members. She signed up after learning about the program from a local mutual aid group. When all 3 of her kids came down with COVID at the same time, she was forced to quit her job and didn't have money to pay for rent and other basic necessities. She said, I had no gas, no Pampers, no wipes. Durham Neighbors helped contribute so I could make sure my children get what they need. It's just really been a help because it's very hard out here, especially being a single parent. In addition to the monthly $50, Durham Neighbors has an emergency fund for members experiencing family or health crises. When Adam's son died last year, she says the program gave her extra money to help cover funeral costs. Much of Durham Neighbors' social media content revolves around the concept of a universal basic income, UBI, also known as guaranteed income, a consistent government-guaranteed payment with no strings attached, meant to provide all citizens with a basic standard of living. It's not a new concept, but due to widespread financial hardship brought on by the pandemic, it is becoming an increasingly salient idea. A recent New York Times article reported that private programs are currently piloting guaranteed income programs in more than 17 states, distributing more than $25 million a year to over 7,000 families, and evidence from previous experiments show that it's an effective model. When the city of Stockton, California, wrapped up a two-year UBI program that provided 125 residents with $500 a month, participants showed in improvements in physical and mental health, as well as increased employment, counter to critics' arguments that stipends reduced their incentive to work. In January, the city of Durham joined in on the momentum, launching Excel, a pilot program that will provide $500 a month to 129 formerly incarcerated individuals over the course of the next year. Well, I must curtail reading of this and any future articles of this week's issue of Indie Week and direct you, listeners, to IndieWeek.com, where those articles are, with sidebars and other articles, are included. I had no time to read some music reviews, theatrical things, and just wanted to point out to you about the Summer Camp Guide. Now, the Summer Camp Guide in Indie Week provides about 10 pages of extensive summer camps from all ages, and many of them outdoor activities, of course, some overnight camping, and COVID-safe precautionary camps, too, still available. And you can find that insert either in print at Indie Week or the IndieWeek.com website. So I will now have to bid you farewell from IndieWeek.com. I'm John Federson.